the results were a little different than what I heard from other sources on the internet. I think that was also around the time that Spleeter came out. I played around a lot with Spleeter, and Spleeter was quite good at the time. This is late 2019. This is almost the Stone Age of where we are now.
Sorry, right?
Yeah.
That's ancient, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Welcome, everybody, to the February episode of our podcast, Spatial Audio Monthly, also known as The SEM Show, where we talk about all things spatial audio. My name is Michael Wagner, and next to me is my co-host, Sam Hawking.
Hello.
Today we have a really interesting guest, Anthony, and we are going to switch things around a little because Anthony has to leave a little early. So we are going to start with the discussion with Anthony, and I'm going to simply turn it over to Sam. And Sam, Anthony, let's start it off.
Great stuff. Yeah, many thanks for joining us, Anthony. It's taken a little while to get you here, but you're a busy man. So it's all perfectly fine. I'm quite a big user of one of the products that you work on, UVR5 Ultimate Vocal Remover, which is kind of, even though my main interest is spatial audio, I use the tools to create stems to separate out spatially. So that's where I've heard about you. But tell us a little bit about you and I know the UVR project is kind of like the GUI of a pre-existing vocal remover, more command line kind of type product.
Explain
why you got into it, what your interest is in audio source separation, and why you continue to work on UVR5 and stuff like that.
I've always been into audio, I've always been into music. It's always really been a passion of mine, I guess, to kind of get started from the very beginning. I work in IT. That's my day job. I do IT security, so I'm already familiar with all things IT related. And I've always been a huge music buff, music fan. I've made music. I understand certain aspects of music. And I've always wanted to be able to hear instrumental versions of songs and stuff. So I remember one day I was in late 2019, I was on GitHub, and I was just kind of looking around for stem separators, because I found out that started to become a thing after I discovered I can't remember the name of the service, but there was an AI service. I think it was called Phonic Mind. I think that's what it was.
Okay.
Yep. I discovered a service that was like that, and I was like, oh, this is cool. This exists. Right. This is possible. And I started looking around GitHub to see if there's any open source versions of it. And then I found there was one called Vocal Remover. It was made by a developer in Japan.
Yeah.
That's kind of what kicked things off. And I installed it. I started using it, and I saw that it was actually quite good. The model was basic, but it was better than anything I'd ever tried prior to that.
Yeah.
So I used it, and I was just really impressed with the results, and I started going down the rabbit hole. I started kind of borderline obsessing over it, like how is this happening? How does this work?
Yeah.
The results were a little different than what I heard from other sources on the internet. I think that was also around the time that Spleeter came out. I played around a lot with Spleeter, and Spleeter was quite good at the time. This is late 2019. This is almost the Stone Age of where we are now.
Sorry, right? Yeah.
That's ancient, right?
Yeah. But I remember when I used Spleeter, I was impressed with the results, but I wasn't crazy about the results.
Yeah,
they sounded a bit washed out, and there's still a lot of bleed. And Vocal Remover, the repo I found on GitHub, was made by the Japanese developer. I think his name is Turismo. I don't know how to say his name.
Yeah, I've got it written down. It's spelled T-S-U-R.
Yes.
Yeah. U-M-S-O. Turismo. Turismo, maybe?
There we go. Yes.
Something like that. Yeah.
I liked that one better, because I felt like the stems were a little clearer.
And what was that at the time? What model was that? Was it only a vocal and instrument
that was,
separator?
That was,
is that
that was it? Yeah, it just did two stems. It was
two
a two
stem,
stem
yeah.
separator.
Two stem model, yeah.
Dual stem model. And Spleeter did four, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I never really dig too much into Spleeter's into Spleeter's code like I did with VR, MDXNet, and DMUX. But but I believe Spleeter was just, it was a multi-stem removal. I was, at the time, I was more interested in dual stems because I just wanted to do vocal and instrumental. And when I did the, when I played around with Vocal Remover, I saw how good it was and I wanted to figure out how to train my own models. So I started off using my laptop, which is a, which is pretty weak at the time. I mean, it was, I couldn't really train much. I think I trained on like, I trained with incredibly low settings and I started with a really small data set of like maybe, you know, 100 or 200 samples. And the model came out better than what, than the default that VR came out with. So I was even more impressed by the results and I was just like, oh wow, this can get better. So I started to
get a faster GPU.
Get a faster GPU.
Yeah.
Build a better computer. And at the time, I think I got one. I went from one. The first model I trained was on 6 gigabytes of VRAM, 1060. 1060 NVIDIA, I believe. That's the one that was on the laptop with six gigs of VRAM, which is barely enough to get a good model. So I upgraded to a. I can't remember the name of that model. The name of that GPU. It was a. It was a 12 or 11 gigabyte GPU. I'll just say that. It was NVIDIA, obviously. I had to be. And that I was able to kind of expand training a bit more. And I started getting better models. And so when I started getting better models, it's like, well, you know, I really want to wrap a GUI around this.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, the project was really just for me. I didn't intend for it to become this big thing. So at the time I was still even though I was really into all things IT, programming was still a weak point for me at the time. I mean, I understood it to a degree. I was able to read, you know, kind of read it a little bit, but I wasn't like nowhere near where I am now. So
sure.
I remember I went to Fiverr, that site where you can find people. That's where I found Boskin Dylan.
Ah, right.
He's one of the early I still credit him. Yeah, and that's where I met him. And I asked him. I said, "Hey, I want to turn this into a GUI. Can you help me?" And you know, I paid him some. Contracted him basically to help me get it started. And so he and I kind of worked together. I showed him what my vision was. This is how I wanted it to look. This is the idea that I had. I just want something that's easier for me to use. I just don't want to have to keep using the command line. So so he made a very bare bones, stripped down, like early version of it. If you go through UVR's old repo, you'll see the very first iteration of it. Like if you go
that was
way back to the history.
Like version 2 or something, and now we're version 5. So
quite
a lot of development.
It looked very bare. It had very few options. It had a very ugly banner that I made. But Dylan was great, and like he and I worked really, really well together. And you know, we kind of took the conversation off of Fiverr. We started kind of discussing things more about like, yeah, how can we make this a little bit better? And you know, he's a very, very, very talented coder. Very, very good. Excellent. He kind of built the foundation, the early foundation for what it is now. Like it's like, you know, if you kind of compare it to building a house, like he kind of poured the foundation, right? Like
sure.
And kind of helped me put the blueprints together. Go ahead.
So was that using models that you created yourself? Tweaked? Yeah. So mm-hmm. even
yeah, that was the very even, first. Yeah,
even the
very,
first stage,
very,
yeah.
Very, right. Very first stage. The earliest iteration of Vocal Remover, I can't pronounce his name, Turismo. His first, like I think his V2 of his Vocal Remover. So those models really weren't that strong, and the data set really wasn't that strong either. And on GitHub, I I think it was about maybe 2 months in, I decided, you know what, this project looks pretty good. I should post it on GitHub. So I posted it on GitHub and I called it Ultimate Vocal Remover. I just kind of, the name just kind of came to me. I couldn't really think of anything better because I wanted to call it something, but I didn't know what to call it. So I just said, you know, Ultimate Vocal Remover. This is to me the best vocal remover I can find. I've created myself. So to me, this is the ultimate vocal remover. So that's what I'm going to call it.
Well, to credit you, it probably still is, to be honest.
I'd like to think so.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Even up against, but for those that aren't aware of it, because there will be listeners that just don't know what the hell we're talking about at the moment, probably. But it's an application that you download, you install it on your computer, it runs on CPU, but it's a lot better and faster on a GPU. And essentially, it takes in a stereo source and it spits out stems or instruments and a vocal from that source, and you've created the application that basically eases the point of entry, I guess you'd call it, in that you don't need to know anything about, I guess it's mainly Python, and you don't need to run stuff from a command line and get so geeky about it. You can literally drag and drop a file in and it pumps out what you want, and you can tweak some settings and yeah, and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, to put it in perspective, you've got commercial services like Lalal and I can't remember some of the names. You basically pay them per the minute or per the song to separate them. And an ultimate vocal remover stands up to those and often does a better job as well, even though it's completely free. So.
By the way, for those of you who are watching on the video version of this podcast, we're going to leave links in the description so you can check that out yourself.
Yeah, we will do. Yeah. But yeah, no, sorry, carry on with.
No,
so
no,
your story got to the point that you've launched this product that's it's followed on from the Japanese developer to take
originally.
Into a GUI. Originally. And, and I guess. Yeah, carry on with the journey up to the point that we're at now, because I guess quite a lot has changed. Even in the time that I've known it, for the last 2 years it's changed a lot.
Yeah, it catapulted into something completely different from its original from my original goal. It just kind of took on a life of its own.
Sure.
From that point, whenever I first posted on GitHub, and I posted the models that I had trained on GitHub as well, it started getting more traction. And, you know, people finally had a, because Turismo's vocal remover was already gaining popularity in and of itself, but then people saw there was a GUI version of it that I posted with slightly better models. So people started using that. And that's where it caught the attention of Aufrey. Well, I call him Aufrey. I mean, he's by screen name, AUFR33. He's the other developer, core developer I credit. And he found me on GitHub, and he posted on one of the issues and said, "Hey, you know, there's some imperfections here that I think I can help you with." And I gave him my email, and then that took UVR in a new direction too. So he and I started talking data and, like, you know, how the models could be better, and we kind of got together and made it even better.
Yep.
So
he's a coder as well.
He's also a programmer.
Into training and AI models and stuff. Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. he runs X Minus.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we got together. We put our heads together, and we're trying to figure out ways to make things better. And he had a multiband approach, so he edited the original VR code to add multiband training to it, which is basically a way for
to explain to people that.
Yeah.
To be unaware, VR is one of the architectures that is used in VR architecture. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's others like DMux and MDX, and is that fair summation? Yeah, okay,
that's correct. Yeah,
great stuff.
It's one of the process methods, what I call it.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the AIs. So I mean, really, UVR has three separate AI networks. No, really four, actually, technically. First being VR, MDXNet, DMux, and then MDXNet 23C, which is actually the newest version of MDXNet. It is technically a different network, but it shares some components with the original MDXNet. So it was, I've had to code them all in. But at this part of my story where I'm at is that it only had VR in it, and Offrey, the other developer I started working with, he kind of introduced a multi-band approach, which is, I guess, to kind of to find a way to kind of explain this on a more simplistic level. Basically, VR uses audio spectrograms, like it analyzes audio spectrograms. It converts them to the FFT spectrogram. Yeah. And it uses, which I'm sure most of the audience probably knows, that spectrograms are basically just heat maps of audio.
Of audio,
you can
actually
see the frequency. So the AI basically looks at those and, you know, determines like what the vocals look like and what it doesn't. Now, VR specifically only uses magnitude spectrograms, not phase, because there's magnitude being, which is what represents the intensity of each frequency, so you can see it more, and then phase representing the timing of where that data is. Phase is a whole hell of a lot harder to predict on a spectrogram than magnitude is, and VR only focuses on magnitude only. It actually uses the original phase from the mixture. Like, it saves the original phase from the mixture when it does a process, and it just does the magnitude. So that's part of the reason why VR tech tends to have more artifacts in it. And you get that, and you'll hear at certain points, some people think it sounds cleaner or clearer, but what the drawback is that you end up getting an instrumental that sounds a little bit more smeared. Like, there's a smeared sound, like it sounds a little bit more synthetic because the phase from the mixture is still in there. And so you can hear it, you could hear the vocal sound a little bit statically. That's the phase that didn't get processed. So even though it technically sounds better, I guess some songs do, I can say.
Yeah,
it's
important to say that there's no one hit solution, which always works the best. A lot of the fun of it on the rabbit hole that you go down is there's a million and one ways that you could demix something. And even though something we'll probably get onto SDR and stuff like that, and how people try and get to the top of an SDR kind of ranking. It's not always the best way to approach demixing a song, because the song itself can determine what might work better than others.
And it's going to differ based on whatever track you're using. I think for acoustic tracks that don't have a whole lot of noise in it, I guess,
lower transient kind of content,
right?
Stuff.
Like if you're throwing a metal song, like in all, because I've played around with just about every genre you can think of, and one of the hardest genres to remove vocals from cleanly is metal. Metal or anything that has a metal and tracks, that non-acoustic tracks that have really heavy vocals in them, like really vocal centered mixes, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Or heavy.
So that full, it's like a full spectrum sound, like very quite white noisy.
Yeah,
so
if the vocals have more intensity, higher intensity, if they're mixed with higher intensity, they're typically going to be harder to remove. And if the instrumental has a lot of intensity, if there's a lot of noise, like you get in like distortion, like distorted guitar from metal, it's going to be harder. You're going to get more of a muddy sound. So I guess after Offrey had, I call him Offrey. Which is the other developer I started to work with, whenever he started, he took on a multi-band approach, which basically just, before, you just got the one spectrogram. Basically, what he coded in is that it learned based on different resolutions. So I was trying to explain resolutions. Okay, so that's a whole other. There's so many parts of it. I guess to kind of make it easier to explain. Basically, he made it so that multiband. Let's say when you see a model that says three band, it means that like, he has the bottom band of like maybe between 0 to let's say 700 hertz has one resolution, maybe a finer resolution, because those are usually the harder frequencies to get to, and then like frequency between 700 and let's say 3000 or might have a different resolution, and then everything above that's going to have a different resolution. So that's basically what he means by multi-band. It's like each band, each certain, a three band will have just different resolutions.
And you'll find typically a vocal will be in a certain band and a bass will obviously be in a lower band. And so you can, you can optimize it based on the, what you're trying to separate basically, I guess.
Exactly. So with that, that was, that made the VR models a lot better.
Able to
do a lot better training on that. And so that really picked up steam and that made UVR even more popular. So in, at this point, this is when he started to kind of, he and I started to work on different methods that we could use, different processes like ensembling. That was one thing. That was one,
Explain what that is. I mean, I know what it is, but it's not an obvious kind of,
so it's basically
even if you're using the online services, you would be aware that they might be being ensembled.
The way the ensemble works is it basically just it's a way for you to use multiple models. Like if there's three or four models, you can use all of them to do the separation to get a potentially better result. There are three ways to ensemble. There's averaging, which basically just takes all the results from, let's say, the vocal and instrumental stem and just averages them. So you're getting an average of all three. Let's say we have an ensemble of three models. So you're going to get an average of the three outputs that come from those three models. If you use max spec, that means that you're going to get the maximum result basically from for each stem.
For each stem, yeah.
Yeah, like basically. Yep. So where, for example, like if in the vocal stem, you'll notice that like if you use max spec, you'll get the heaviest weighted vocal from each model. And the same thing goes for instrumental too.
Yeah.
And you might even get cleaner instrumentals out of it, but you might get more artifacts. That's the trade-off. Yeah. There's always a trade-off between which one you use.
And people will choose different specific models that might complement each other in an ensemble, i.e. you might have one that it is good at separating some aspects of a vocal but not another, but you know that another model is actually a little bit better, so if you apply that as well, you kind of get the best of both worlds and average it out. Sometimes it's an iterative process because you don't actually know how it's going to work until you've actually demixed it, and then you realize if I try this model that might improve it, and sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better.
So that was a big breakthrough. I mean, the min spec and max spec were actually a big breakthrough in ensembling. And Offrey was the one that kind of, like, because I had the idea, and then he kind of was able to help bring it to life. It was actually a very simple find too. It's like, all we need to do is, you know, I won't get into the code, but like coding wise, it ended up being a lot simpler than we thought, and more and really effective too. So at this point, I was like, okay, so. Boskin Dylan, who was, you know, who helped me in the GUI way in the earlier phases. He dropped out because he, you know, at that point, this was, I want to say mid 2021. He dropped out because, he's from Austria and I think he had to do military service or something. I'm not exactly sure, but he had personal reasons why he had to drop out. So it was on me. So then the project kind of, the GUI wise from that point on was just on me. It's not to say that, Dylan definitely mentored me a lot and helped me understand certain coding aspects that I didn't quite understand before. And he really helped me kind of like, he gave me enough information and he gave me, he helped me understand enough to where I was able to kind of take it and just go my own direction with it.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, cool. And this is around the point I want to say, around, you know, from mid 2021 all the way up until 2022, I was exclusively working on it. Now around this time, I had the GUI was still a bit more basic. It wasn't I hadn't had an installer for it yet. So when I came out with the next release in early 2022, I was getting a lot of complaints in GitHub. Like, I don't know how to install this thing. I'm having trouble, and because you have to go through the manual install. Frustrates. Yeah. So I was like, I didn't have the bandwidth to keep. To help everybody. At that point. So I was like, okay, well, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to, I'm going to make an installer for it. And I'm going to try to package the whole thing together. And, that's when I started to take it more seriously. And I was like, okay, nearly all of my free time was dedicated to UVR. Like I was just glued to, you know, that was, it was a, I was spending like maybe 10 plus hours a day for, I want to say almost a year straight on UVR. Like I put a lot of work and effort into it at that during this time. I figured out how to package it. And then I wanted to recode everything, and I wanted to clean everything up because I wanted the code to be easier to maintain. So I put the package together, the installer together, and I got help from for design, Boss Cortez. That's his screen name. He designed the new logo. He designed the new UVR logo, and he also gave me some tips. I'm like, maybe you should use these colors. I think this would make it look better. And I was just like, you know, I'm really glad I took his advice, because I'm not a designer. So his input was great.
But for those that don't, that aren't a part of there's a Discord community where UVR is a forum on there, basically. And all of these names, if you really got into the sort of people that are behind how this all progresses and moves forward, all these names, these sort of handles, are in this Discord community, basically. Is that fair? That's kind of how I understand it anyway. So
my handle being
Antrok. And your handle is Antrok. Just in case, there's no real names behind any of this. It's a modern kind of development kind of community.
That's a good way to put it.
It's a modern development community.
Yeah, for the most part, prior to this, nobody really knew my face. So, I mean, now they do.
Yeah.
But at that point of development, when I say Boss Cortez, he's the one that developed the logo, he developed the banner, and he kind of gave me some insights on like how the GUI should flow.
And then usability kind of side of it,
that's very valuable feedback, and I guess that kind of dovetails into another point that I was going to make in terms of user feedback. User feedback was also like the early users were instrumental in making UVR what it is today too, because a lot of their feedback and a lot of their suggestions and a lot of what their thoughts were really, really helped inform because I took all of that and I used it to make UVR better, and it got a lot better. So I mean, all the work that I put into it there in the early days was early 2022 anyway, was based on that, and going forward it was based on that. Once I released the GUI version in mid 2022. I want to say it was in May. I released the first installer for it. Like we're now, this is more accessible to people who didn't quite know Python. And that was another goal I had too, because I didn't want people to have to. I wanted it to be more accessible to people who aren't very programming inclined. Because not everybody's going to want to sit in front of the computer trying to figure out how to install Python and do all these other things. One of my biggest goals was to make this accessible at that point. And a lot of people love the product, and a lot of people loved UVR and loved the models, but they didn't like the fact that they couldn't quite understand how to install it at the time. So having the installer, I think, really catapulted it. And at that time, I had already added a new network. I added the additional networks. This is when I added MDXNet and DMUX. Now, I found amongst all of the networks, MDXNet is my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably because, where most of the exciting stuff's happening at the moment as well.
Yes.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
MDXNet, I mentioned earlier that VR architecture only uses magnitude spectrograms. Yep. Not phase. Yeah. MDXNet, on the other hand, uses the full spectrogram with phase and magnitude together.
Yep.
So you get a slightly better separation. Now, the trade-off is that some songs might sound, to some people might sound a little bit muddier, I guess. Like there might be, but overall it sounds more natural, right? Like, and it is cleaner. So MDX. So from that point on, I started basing my sights on training just MDXNet models. And at this point, our data set was bigger, and it was more representative of what of the kind of issues that it we were trying to address.
Yeah, just to explain what you mean by data set. That's kind of when we can go into how models are trained maybe a little bit, but essentially the data set is what you're initially training the model on in order to recognize what it is going to separate from these spectrographs.
Yeah, basically.
It's like a sieve. You're sieving out a certain type of sound, and how good that sieve is how clean the sound. Is that a good analogy?
I guess with training, training is usually there are several aspects of it that need to be considered if you want a good model.
Yeah.
Data set being number one.
Yeah.
That's like a model is only going to be as strong as the data that you train it on. Sometimes.
Yeah. So just to be clear, the data set is kind of like your original stems. That you're training on, and you're going to compare that to those stems that were mixed into a stereo track.
Yeah.
Then you can compare the effectiveness of how good your stem is out of the model compared to what the stem originally was before it was mixed.
Exactly. It's the data set consists of official stems.
Yeah. Like the official.
Like so so the data set has official instrumentals and official vocals in it. Like that are not AI based. They're usually mixed. It took a long time for us. Basically, the data set's just a lot of data that was scraped from the internet to just try to of vocal stems and instrumentals, and we put those together. And of course, there was also the karaoke models, which that's all free. He was the mastermind between that behind that data set and those models. I contributed mostly to the main data set for the main models. Other aspects of it too are also model size, capacity, the number of in and out channels in the models itself. And setting that I found to be easier in MDXNet than in VR. In VR, it's like there just wasn't enough granularity in terms of how big or small it could make the models. I mean, there was, but not as much as MDXNet. I also tried training a DMUX model too. And that one wasn't quite as successful. I think DMUX was more programmed to handle more stems. So when I tried to do a dual stem separator for DMUX, it came out, it was a decent model. It just wasn't as good as MDXNet or the others. It was, I would say, the weaker of them.
Yeah. For those who don't know, the DMUX was a
Facebook.
Kind of a developer out of Facebook,
AD Foz was the developer, very, very, very good developer.
And that's still, I get to a certain point, very usable four or six stem model. Mm-hmm. Part of Ultimate Vocal Remover, and I use it all the time.
Ultimate Vocal Remover wasn't intended to be what it is today. It just kind of took, like I said, it took on a life,
took a life
of its
own.
So I at that point I wanted it, and enough people were using it that I wanted it to be, my goal was to make it the Swiss Army knife of audio source exploration, people wouldn't have to
take bits and pieces from everywhere,
everywhere, and then you have it all in one, right? So you can also use all of the official released DMUX models that weren't made by us. You can also load those into the or models that other people train. You can load those into UVR and use them. Same thing goes for MDXNet and VR.
Yeah,
and in fact, quite a few of the models that are used in now, at least, like the Reverb model, the Denoise model, some of those, those weren't trained by me. Those were actually trained by the community.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I just included.
Yeah, so, we should probably mention that this isn't a one man or two or three man.
Yeah,
kind of effort. There's a whole community that kind of feeds off of itself, and those models that not a huge amount of people making them, but those that are making them can end up inside Ultimate Vocal Remover, because it's been designed that way that you can, I mean, you've got a repository yourself that you've got like a standard set of models that come when you download it, but then you can download extra models on top of that. I think it's quite important to stress that the models are kind of driving what you're going to do in the interface to a certain extent, because there might be a feature that you can add to that interface in order to better use that model. I guess that's coming back to what you said. You don't have to pull all this way of working from multiple places. It's visually all there in front of you, and you say, "Oh right, well let's try this with a min max average, or let's try increasing the overlap size." And it's very quick to just try something, basically. And you don't have to process the whole song or the whole album. You can just do a slice of 20 seconds or something, and see if it works before you go for the big kind of, you know, process all in one go at maybe a higher resolution or whatever.
And I think there's a I'll say that those settings there was so much, like, I think one other thing too is that I've gotten so much feedback and a lot of community support. I wanted to accommodate everybody, and I wanted to accommodate everything. Speaking to some of the challenges I've had with this, is that since I am really, when it comes to coding the GUI, when it came to coding that part of it and really getting all that together, I was pretty much a one-man show on that part in particular. And it was hard because it's like, because with projects of this magnitude, of this size, usually have bigger teams behind it. Bigger teams that are focused on it, right?
The GUI, you would have, somebody would have just been developing the GUI and
Certain features in the GUI too. Like somebody would be focused on, like, you know, getting the secondary model part in there, or like would be focused on getting, making the MDX or integrating MDXNet into it. Another coder would integrate Demux into it, right? That part was all me, and that was I think that was going to kind of go into one of the biggest challenges I had in terms of testing and debugging and stuff. Like that was probably it was stressful because I didn't want to release a product with bugs or anything like that. But when you are one developer doing all of those things at once, it's like I kind of had to rely on the community to be my bug reporters and to be my guinea pigs. And I didn't like that. That's the part I feel like I've built up a certain level of trust with the community. So I want to release a product that's stable, as stable as it possibly can be, but I can't test everything myself. So certain bugs are going to come up that I'm not aware of, or that are just obscure, or certain issues are going to come up. So I've had to release a lot of different versions, a lot of different patches, right? And that's something I tried to avoid doing. And that's why there's so many patches of UVRs, because I have to rely on the community to tell me where some of these bugs are that I'm just not going to find.
When you accept a kind of buy me a coffee kind of donation, and that does get you some extra models and stuff like that. But essentially there's no charge for it. So I think anyone that is aware of, you know, how it's come about, of kind of, they perfectly accept that you know, this isn't a commercial. And plenty of commercial products don't bloody work any either. So I must admit, I've never really had any issues with DMix. I mean, you get the odd crazy thing that might happen with the GPU, just like it would in gaming or anything. But to your credit, it's pretty flawless kind of operation, really.
I appreciate that. But I feel like I guess maybe this is the perfectionist in me. I want it to work for everybody.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's seamlessly.
Yeah, well, if you're
perfectly.
Spending 10 hours a day on this right, for a year or two, then yeah. you are a perfectionist. There's no doubt about that.
You want it to work for, and it's not necessarily because it's not really me. It's just because, I mean, it's more that I want people to get a good experience out of it. I want people to get the right, I want them to be able to use it properly. And like, that's why I extended to Mac, to making it usable on Mac. In fact, I spent a considerable amount of time devoted to the Mac users so that it would be compatible, like in being able to use the new M1, M2, M3 chips as GPUs, which I'll say is that was one of my biggest breakthroughs. Although I will say I did find that it was based off of some fixes that I found that a user on the Demux repo had found. And I kind of took that and I was like, oh, this is, I can make the GPU on the Macs work. And that was, I think, one of the best breakthroughs, because it made it so that you could use pretty much any model now.
Yeah. Yeah.
At good speed on Macs.
Yeah. No, I think everyone was, it's because the music community's quite a Mac kind of centric.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the States, probably more than in Europe, maybe to a certain extent, but.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like DJs remixers and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They use mostly, at least from what I see, a lot of them use Mac.
Yeah.
Even some of the videos that I've seen on YouTube, like of users talking about UVR, they're on a Mac. So I'm like, okay, so I need to make sure that I devote enough time on Macs to make this as usable on there as I can.
Yeah. I've shared it with, I mean, I've come at some of the kind of Dolby Atmos engineers that I work for, demixing stuff for them. A couple of them are using it, so and they're on Mac, so they're definitely happy with it. So I guess we could wonder whether we should kind of just a high level kind of overview of how you would get from, you've got this data set, you've got this bunch of tracks, stems, just give a rough, it doesn't need to be specific to a specific architecture or whatever. Just what's the basic kind of process that is gone through to get from you've got this folder of data set of stems and you're going to train a model and something comes out the end of that and that then ends up in Ultimate Vocal Remover. How does that process kind of work? Just, you know, just in layman's terms, just so somebody can understand it from a high level perspective.
So you're saying like when you put, like, are you talking about in training or inferencing? Like,
I guess the complete process from, you were saying, right, I'm going to train a new MDX model.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Just a basic kind of overview of how that happens.
There's a lot of
equipment you've got to use and stuff, like, you know, the GPUs and stuff.
I now use a, I guess GPU wise, I'll start with the hardware. Now I use an A6000 NVIDIA GPU. It's got a lot more VRAM. It's got 48 gigs of VRAM.
Yeah.
So that kind of helps. I have a, I think it's a 58, an X5800 Ryzen CPU. You want to have a decent CPU too, I think. I have 128 gigabytes of system RAM.
Yeah.
Not sure if you need that much, but I have it anyway.
You got it, yeah.
you want to have a lot of hard drive storage to handle, depending on how big your data set is. So I have an NVMe 4 terabyte, which is definitely big enough and fast, because you want to have an SSD. Don't use a...
Just to make it clear to everyone, there's a huge amount of files that are getting processed here. It's not just an album of music. This is
it's
hundreds
a lot
and
of data.
Possibly thousands of individual stems, mm-hmm. and that's just to get to a model. Just to get a decent model.
You can get rudimentary models or more specialized models with smaller data sets, that are in the lower hundreds, right? Like 200. I would say you want to keep your minimum at about 200. At least have 200 samples of something. Rather you're making a karaoke data set, a crowd data set, or a reverb data set, right? Like, you want to have at least minimum 200 if you want some good, decent results, right? Anything under that, and you might not get the results that you want. Anything over that, and you'll get better results. And then from there, you also want to consider, I guess, from the training perspective, how big you want your model to be. I know that in the training process for MDXNet, you can choose the FFT size, how the resolution of the spectrogram, how big you want that to be. That's considered. The in and out channels of a model, that's how you want to set, which is basically the size of the channels. I won't get too granular into that part just because it's a lot, and I don't even fully understand it the way that I want to, but I understand it enough because I don't want to speak on something I don't understand as well as I should, but I know that that's you want to increase if you want to at least if you have the hardware,
yeah,
the larger, the bigger the model capacity is, the more resource intensive it's going to be.
Right. Yeah.
So you also have to kind of balance that too. So if you have a smaller data set, your model capacity doesn't have to be as large, because if you have a large model capacity, like if you make the model capacity too large with a small data set, you're going to run the risk of overfitting. The model will overfit on just that data set. And overfitting basically means that the model is only going to learn the features of that data set too well that it's not going to be able to generalize and learn and understand how to pull the data it's supposed to from
other songs,
unknown songs, that's never seen before, right?
Yeah.
So large model capacity, small data set will result in overfitting, but a small model capacity with a large data set is going to result in it not really learning much at all, because it's going to basically forget the features of a larger data set. It's not going to work well. So you kind of want to balance those two things out well, right? And you also want to, batch size is also something else you want to consider. Batch size is the amount of samples that are being fed into the model as it's being trained. Smaller batch size are going to take longer to learn. Smaller batch sizes are going to make the model take longer to learn, but you might get a slightly better result at the end. Larger batch sizes, the model might not learn as well because it's having to learn bigger batches at once, but the model will train faster. So you also have to kind of balance that out too. So kind of having to fine tune and tweak those settings, I think, is kind of key in understanding what works for your data set, what works for whatever model you're training. I know that I've had to kind of balance out, because I know vast majority of UVR's users don't have these big beefy GPUs, right? A lot of them, some of them are still using CPU, right? So I kind of want to still accommodate for that. So I don't want to make the model so large that they can barely run it. Like MDX 23C is our larger models with the bigger capacity sizes, and those are very resource intensive. And a lot of users complain that while the model is very good, it's very slow, even on decent GPUs, like a lower end, like a 3040, right? Or I'm sorry, a 3050. Right. Like, which is newer, but it's still going to be slower because it doesn't have as much VRAM and all that other stuff. and then of course the users that are using AMD, which I recently expanded usage to AMD, GPUs and, Intel Arc using OpenCL. And those are going to be a little bit slower just in general, faster than a CPU, but a little slower than what NVIDIA will give you. but I wanted to accommodate for that too, in terms of the models that I make. The model that I'm training now that I'm going to be coming out with sometime in the next couple of weeks or so, is a little smaller, but better than the best regular MDXNet model that I have. The idea was, is I wanted to make the model a little smaller just so that it could be more usable. So it's not as resource intensive. In terms of training, those are the things that's kind of what goes into it. And for me, typically, depending on how large your data set is too, if I have like 3,000 samples of like average song lengths of like, you know, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, it's going to take, at least, with a batch size of, let's say, batch size of 8, about maybe a month and a half.
I think that's all people don't appreciate. That's what one very, very powerful GPU running for a month and a half continually just to get the model at the end of it. And this is why it's not, I mean, it, I guess the process is relatively simple to get into because a lot of the back end stuff's kind of already done in.
Yeah.
You know, because it's the same AI that's training that's been used for various things, but.
I think one thing I want to mention too is that I want to give credit where credit's due. It's like because MDXNet was made by a group of very talented developers in QuiLab from the University of Korea. Like yeah. That was their baby. They did it's my favorite network. So if they're watching, they did an amazing job
making that. Actually, they will be.
Yeah, it's like they're. Woo Sung Chi, I think his name is. I've not interacted with him a whole lot, but I'm a big fan of his work. He did a great job.
Yeah. I mean, for those that aren't aware of kind of these terminologies, there's like the MDX, especially the MDX 23 stuff is extremely good at vocal separation. It's on the right track. It can be almost as usable as a pure stem that's just come straight from the studio.
Yeah.
So yeah, no doubt I think everyone's impressed by it. And it will do a better job than most of the commercial stuff out there.
I agree. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that Lala's good. I think a lot of what's coming out now, I'm excited about it. Like I want to keep UVR free always, forever. Like I don't ever plan on monetizing it. Like making it commercial, basically. It's always going to be open source. I want this to be accessible to everybody. And I also want to encourage other companies to make this process better. Like, so I'm glad that Death Services like Lala and Moises exist because it's like, I'm excited to see what type of breakthroughs that they'll come out with. And then there was another one. Audio Shake. Yeah. That's the one I was thinking about. Audio Shake. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what they come out with. I'm excited to see how they improve this technology because right now I think the biggest hurdle is phase.
Right.
Part of what's causing the muddiness. I mean, really it's also finding a better way altogether, but right now in source separation, there's not a great way to calculate phase in a model. Like it's like the phase spectrogram because they're not as obvious as a magnitude spectrogram is. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to, this is almost leading into your like demudding process that we've discussed about as well. So I guess the easiest way to describe demudding is you're kind of taking, this is my very crude explanation of it, you're doing a much better job than me, Anthony, but you essentially, when you take, for example, you take the vocal out of a heavy rock track, some of that vocal will pull some of that instrumental kind of with it simply because the process is not perfect and there's a kind of like an overlapping identical phase, I guess would you call it?
Yes, yeah. Like basically it's like because they can't, right now source separation cannot calculate phase as accurately as I wish it could, is that there's going to be some even if you hear a vocal track, like let's say the vocal stem, you're not going to hear the instrumental in there, but there is instrumental data in there in the phase of that vocal track.
Sonically it's almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So the model kind of, some of it might have stayed with the instrumental, but some of that instrumental went with the vocal.
Yeah, it's not a perfect separation because at the end of the day, source separation does prediction. It's predicting where it thinks it is, and it's not always going to be accurate. So there's going to be those imperfections that are going to show whenever you hear a muddier sound.
Yeah.
Like I said, with a track that has more noise, like metal tracks, that's usually the best example I can give because they have the most noise.
Yeah. So that's the example you gave on the one that you shared, which is the small kind of, I don't know, 10 seconds.
It was a small 10 second clip from a hard rock artist. So it was easier for me to show that difference.
Yeah.
Now the demudding technique that I use is not one that I don't think anyone uses. I could be wrong. Maybe someone else has thought about it, but to kind of go into the more details of it is, it's kind of hard to explain, but I'm going to do my best.
Yeah.
So because a big part of the problem is phase, I use a lot of phasing tricks. I basically take it. It processes the track twice. The first go around, it takes the instrumental, the output instrumental from that first go around, and it compares it against the original mixture. And what it does is it chops the mixture into chunks, into like 3 second chunks, and it iterates over that list of chunks. And for each segment, it cuts out where that segment is in the instrumental.
Right.
And it finds similar events that aren't at the exact same place. I said this one, you'd be easy to explain.
No. You have explained it, and it's not an easy thing to get around because it's almost going...
Right.
It's like a three-dimensional kind of picture you've got to get in your head.
Right. Yeah. It's like the code is all there. I wish I had a flow chart. I should have made one to show you.
Yeah.
To kind of explain this, but I guess I'm trying to give a higher level explanation of it. Basically what it does is it takes those chunks and it analyzes them against the instrumental that was generated, and it tries to find the most similar events it can. And from the instrumental that aren't at the same place from that segment. And it finds those similar events, and then it phases it. It does a phase invert of that instrumental. And then if the volume or dB threshold isn't past a certain point, because if it's too loud, then it doesn't cancel out some of the audio that's there. It doesn't phase invert.
Yeah.
If it reaches a certain threshold, like if it's below a certain threshold, it'll phase that.
Yeah.
And then it will basically stitch together a new mixture that is...
Ah, right.
Yeah, it stitches together a new mixture that's kind of phased from that original instrumental output.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it reprocesses that new stitched together mixture with the instrumental phase changed.
Yeah.
And it processes that through the second pass, and then it takes that vocal and then phase inverts it with the original mixture.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And then what you end up having some of the parts that were similar from the other parts of the track. You end up having those fill in the spectral holes, so to speak.
Yeah. There are kind of some quite crude spectral hole fillers where that's kind of what it's doing. Like, I think it's, there's probably one in like Isotope RX, but the one I'm aware of is in Stereo Tool, it's called. That's really just taking a whole kind of section. Yeah. And this sounds exactly like that section there. And it kind of cut and paste. But you're actually kind of iteratively looking elsewhere in the spectrograph to spectrogram to get that similar.
I'm trying to get a similar part, right? But I'm trying to take that similar part and phase it with that segment.
Yeah.
Because it's not the exact same part of the segment that's not going to be like a perfect phase, right? Because I don't want it to be, because if it is, then you're just getting the vocal, right?
Like the
original vocal output.
You're trying to find the bit of the instrument that is still in the vocal. Is that
right? Yes. I'll probably show a better example. What I'll do is offline. I'll send you some more examples that maybe you can show in maybe your next podcast.
That'd be great, right?
Way you can cut, because the explanation I'm giving is not.
It's very
hard to explain that process.
Yeah.
It's almost better that I show it.
I think it's just safe to say that the community, when you did share that, a lot of people got quite excited because
it's very effective.
They knew that it was a step. Kind of progress in the
it's a step in the right direction
because no matter how well it separates, when you kind of A and B between the the original stereo track, and then you null out what the vocal is removed. You null that from the stereo track. There's kind of there's always that slight, especially in the kind of more in like the cymbals and hi hat sort of end. You
can
kind of hear it a bit. Kind of just sounds like it's dropped in level a little bit. And I guess that's what you're
that's what I'm
back
trying
to
address. I'm trying to address the issue where it sounds muddy and it sounds like that there's kind of washed out.
Yeah.
Now it's the process is not perfect, right? Like there's still things that I'm still working out with it, but it's because the main goal was to make sure that the audio stayed sounding natural. I didn't want to sound smeared like what you get from the VR models. I wanted to sound natural and I wanted it to sound official and fuller and brighter. That was the idea. And I didn't want to compromise the vocal stem quality at all, right? I didn't want to make sure that that remained. In fact, if anything, I wanted to make that, I wanted to make the vocal stem quality better, which it does in some cases.
Right.
But it also depends on the way that the track was mixed originally. So if it's an analog track that was recorded in one session, right? Or let's say if it's a live track even, the demutter that I have or the process that I have isn't going to work as well with tracks like that. I have a plan B for those, right? Like for demutting, but it's but if it's a continuous recording, it's not because there's not going to be phase similarities on, you know, at 5 seconds into the track compared to like, you know, 10 or a minute in, right? Like there's not going to be other parts for it to really pull from that are exact, that match phase, right? Because it's a live recording. It's like, but if the track was mixed with samples. Like continuous sample loops, like a lot of mixers do that. And if the track is digital, it'll be you'll the likelihood of you getting a successful demud is going to be much or a better result from the demudder is going to be higher. Right?
Yeah, I don't think that's kind of true across most separations. Is the newer sometimes it depends on how heavy it's been limited. I find sometimes, but generally. The older analog stuff is harder to separate than
sometimes it is, yeah.
Cleaner digital,
but and sometimes it's
all
not.
In how it's been processed. Mm-hmm. It's all how it's been mastered, I guess, to some extent.
I notice oddly in some older tracks, like you know, like from track from like the 70s, or early 80s, like they're surprisingly they separate well. I think it's more in terms of the way that the demutter works specifically is that it won't work as well on tracks like that, but. I think when you get to older tracks, like when you get to like the early 60s, like 50s, where it's really old, like older tracks that were originally recorded in mono, those might be a little harder. Like AI will have a little bit of a harder time with those. But whenever you start getting into like the stereo era, early stereo era, it starts getting a little better. but there are still, like I said, there are still drawbacks to it. Like I'm wanting to. And the reason why I'm taking my time with the demutter is because I see the promise in it, and it works really well with a lot of tracks. But there are some tracks it doesn't quite work the way I want it to yet, and I don't want to release it. I would hate to release it or put it in. I would hate to put it into a patch and have a whole group of people love it, and then people say, "Oh, it didn't work for these tracks. It sucks." Right? Yeah. I want it to work well for everybody first. I'm getting there. I think it's just, I make more breakthroughs the more time I spend on it. Lately, it's been harder for me to spend as much time on UVR because, you know, my day job.
You've been busy. Yeah.
They got me back at the office at my day job. So it's like, there's some time constraints that have prevented me from being able to spend as much time. And then there's other things in my personal life, you know, that I have to deal with that makes it make it hard for me to spend as much time. So.
No. I mean, that's, but much appreciate you making the time to come on the podcast because it's definitely somebody that I've wanted to speak to.
Just because I use the tool
so much, you know.
I'm definitely proud of the work that we've done. I'm definitely one of my crowning achievements, I would say. Like in terms, like really, I'm proud of where it's come. I'm proud of I'm proud of the fact that I'm proud of how far I got with it.
Well, considering you weren't necessarily a developer kind of starting point, you've not only have you learned quite a complex part of computing such as AI, you've actually had to teach yourself everything around that to build a GUI and Okay, you've had help along the way, but
Definitely. I couldn't have gotten here without the help, right? Like without Boss and Dylan to kind of help lay out the foundation in the beginning, without Offrey to kind of help with the data sets and the and his input and his expertise and the community and Boss Cortez developing the logo and also other. The community giving its feedback, UVR would not be what it is today without that. And there's a lot of other things that I really hope to implement in the future. Like obviously the Demutter is going to be in there in the next iteration. I'd like to get translations in there because I know that they have a big international community, like a lot of foreign users that don't speak English. I would really like to get a translation feature in there. I would also like to get I also like to make it more accessible for people who are you know visually impaired because I've gotten a lot of there's been a lot of issues on GitHub open for that. So there's a lot of other little things I'm trying to address. It's just that just finding the time to do all that stuff has been difficult, but I'm really proud of how far it's come, and I'm really glad that it's gotten to where it is now, and I'm thankful for the community and for everything.
No, you should be very proud. It's such a cool product.
Yeah.
I think it's still a lot of people that are going to discover it as well. Okay, there's that community on the Discord is, I don't know where, there's 5,000 odd members there. It's a lot more than you'd ever think for something like this, but it's a really active community. Just people that are just trying to get a vocal separated just for kicks. But then people that like myself, which are doing it as a almost as a service to the audio industry as well, and everyone's kind of using this tool. So you're definitely ticking the right boxes.
Yeah, I've tried, and I hope that it gets. Yeah, I hope that it continues to get better. Like I hope that I can continue. I hope new breakthroughs are made in the industry that make it better. I hope that they come out with more phase aware AIs that I can implement so that I don't want to have to use a demutter. I'd like for that to not have to be a thing I want the demutter to become obsolete at some point. That would be nice. And but I hope that that happens.
I think it probably will do because I don't know, maybe there is this ceiling that you won't be able to get past it, but I imagine it.
Yeah.
Every moment in time, people think there's this ceiling that can't be broken, and it nearly always is. But just looking at SDR figures from 2 or 3 years ago to now, you got the bike dance and stuff like that, and it's just continually progressing. Just for everyone that doesn't know what the SDR is, I keep referring to, that's the signal to noise distortion ratio. So it's kind of it's what the model didn't, or how much of the original stem did the model separate against itself, kind of thing. So it's kind of like it's the residue that the lower the residue, the higher that percentage, basically. But it doesn't always mean that it sounds clearer. It might just be that it's effective at separating it. But it's weird. Sometimes the lower SDR actually sounds better than the higher SDR. Yeah.
SDR is a great metric. It is a great metric to kind of see what direction the model's going in. But
generally, if it's good at vocal separation, the inversion of the vocal will create a good instrumental or might create a good drum stem or whatever. So
I think the best metric is user feedback, because sometimes it's like I've heard high SDR models, like some of the highest ones, like will fail at certain points where it won't remove the vocals where it's supposed to, or like so SDR is a very good metric. It's a good place to start, but there's also the human aspect of it.
Well, the perception that should be kind of side of
the
it.
The perception, But the SDRs have gotten much higher over the years. I think that I think my early models were somewhere in 13, 10, 9. point something right, and now it's at 16 point something, right? So it's gotten much higher, and totally. And that's kind of atmospheric, would be anything over 20, like that eventually I hope that they get above that, and hopefully that'll be representative of less muddiness, right? That's that's what I care about the most is the muddiness. It's like, if we can get a model that sounds natural and less muddy, that's yeah. kind of been my primary focus.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think it's a step that is gonna, it probably won't bridge to a overall cleaner model, but you will mm-hmm. learn, or everybody will learn along the way if it's open source, what you've done there, and that, you know, it's just going to feed into itself like any other kind of technology progress. So chapeau to you, Anthony. It's great stuff. We've kind of Michael's there silent in the background at the moment.
Yeah, it's a kind of, you know, people usually make fun of me because I talk so much in a strange accent that nobody understands. But this was absolutely mesmerizing. I was kind of listening quietly and fascinated. You know, kind of it's always fun to see people who really have an extremely deep understanding about the things that they do, and especially if they give back to the community in a way that you do. That was absolutely brilliant. That was fun. Thank you so much for being on this podcast. This was outstanding. Okay, so this was Anthony. This was absolutely great. So let's talk a little bit about the news of this month. Sam, there were a couple of things, and we probably should kind of say that we are recording this podcast at the end of January, even though it goes live in the middle of February. So while we're recording that, NAMM is just taking place. So there are certain things that we know, and other things that are going to happen between the time of recording and the actual time of release of this podcast that we do not know yet. So if we are missing something, don't get upset. We didn't know about those things yet. Right. And I have a couple of lists, items here that I found interesting. And the most interesting thing to me, at least, that happened over the last couple of days was the release of the Audient Aura Dolby Atmos audio interface. I think this is something that was really missing in the entire Dolby Atmos space, you know, kind of especially for people that are like us, a little bit on the home producer, bedroom producer side, an option to have like one unit that can do it all. The Audient Aura interface can be used as an interface or as a monitor controller. And it essentially does everything. So it has 16, I think it has 16, Sam, right? 16 analog outs. And and then essentially you can also run Sonarworks on it, so it does all the things that you need. So this is actually brilliant, and if I'm not mistaken, it is about $3,000, right?
That sounds about right. Yeah, I mean it's kind of taken a lot of the challenges that you face in a multi-channel studio. And kind of wrap them all into a single piece of hardware, I guess.
And it's sort of on our Discord server. And by the way, invert link, I'm going to post it somewhere. On our Discord server, we have the discussion actually quite often that people come into the Discord and they want to know how can we produce Dolby Atmos? How can we set up a Dolby Atmos studio at home? And how can we do that in a cost-effective way? And that is always a challenge because you need, you needed multiple devices. There was not a single interface that had 16 outs. Actually, that's not completely true. There was one, but that was very, really difficult to get. And this now is the first really commercial one. So I'm really excited. I was actually kind of in the process of building a Dolby Atmos studio myself. People don't know, but essentially my video space here is actually very, very small and it's stereo only. And I was in the process of converting my basement when the pandemic hit and I had to stop everything. And kind of this is probably going to restart my thing, because now essentially you can do a Dolby Atmos studio below $10,000. Which is actually substantial.
Yeah. But it would work. It would probably work for lower order ambisonics as well, I would have thought.
That's an interesting one.
I'm not sure. I didn't really look at it from that perspective, but I'm assuming.
I mean, it is completely, yeah, it is to some extent agnostic. So essentially kind of, but it is completely. Well, I mean, it has 16 outs, right? You can obviously kind of feed an ambisonic signal and convert it into a 16 channel audio. So that I think we will see essentially if that makes an impact. That once again, I think opens up the space to many people who did not have access to Dolby Atmos just because of the complexities of setting that up.
Yeah.
Okay, so the second thing, or is there anything else we should talk about in terms of the Aria? Probably not.
I haven't had a chance because of NAMM 24. A lot of stuff has all come out.
There's a lot of stuff
in 48 hours, and it seems like 48 hours.
Yeah, essentially, kind of. I think at the time we are recording this, there was another news release by Sony or something. So it's coming out as we speak, because NAMM is taking place as we're recording this.
Yeah.
The second thing, and that actually happened like 2 weeks ago, was DVR Pro kind of got an update to version 2. It now has a couple of additional capabilities. It used to be, for those of you kind of who don't know, that is a kind of a panning tool that allows you to pan audio sources into multi-channel. And it's a fairly popular one, especially by people who are working with Dolby Atmos. And it used to be a mono only, so you could only kind of pan a mono source into multi-channel, but now it is stereo. And it also has an additional little application that allows you to add a head tracking device. It used to be that you needed the Spatial Audio Connect, which was a kind of a VR application that you could run in a virtual reality environment. And they now kind of added a little application that does not need a VR headset, so you can actually use, like, for, I think they have a video on their site where they show how to use the Subaper head tracker. I'm honestly not completely sure. We talked before we recorded that we talked about it a little. I'm not quite sure what the purpose of a head tracker in a panner is, but and many people got actually quite excited about that. Have you tried, Sam? Have you ever tried kind of that DVR Pro?
I've to use it. I used it more before I had a Dolby Atmos renderer, because I've Windows based. The Dolby Atmos side came later. Yeah. So when I was messing it, because it can do ambisonics as well, DVR, I think, if I remember.
I'm honestly not sure about the version number one, but the second version can do ambisonics, yes.
Initially I was kind of just, as I was exploring spatial audio, that's one of the, well, like we were saying before we came on air, it's one of the earlier kind of multi-channel panners that you could buy commercially.
It has a full room simulation. So in addition to a reverb, there's also reflections, and you can change the room sizes. So for somebody who is sort of coming from a virtual reality space, that is very enticing, because essentially allows you to simulate kind of really spaces.
Yeah, I mean, you can put it on each kind of mono or stereo track or stem, and use it like a panner that you would in Atmos today.
And the reality really is starting to make a big impact in the music space. You know, kind of, we were talking before we started recording, also kind of, I just got the Sennheiser 490s, which are the new Sennheisers, which are excellent, by the way, and they come with a mix version of DVR. DVR, or Dear Reality is the company, DVR is the product. They're really kind of trying hard to become kind of a staple in the spatial audio space, or even more of a staple in the spatial audio space. A lot of people already like it anyway. Then another thing that came out yesterday, actually, the day before we're recording, that was the Immerse Virtual Studio for Apple Music. You are Windows only, Sam, right?
I have a Mac as well, but for music, it's Windows only,
It's because, unfortunately, that essentially requires a Mac, and that actually requires one with, and I actually didn't know that, that requires an Apple Silicon Mac. The Apple Music head tracking apparently only works on Apple Silicon, or at least kind of the application program interface that they provide.
Yeah, this sounds like it's mirroring the... what was the company? Audio Movers plugin,
The Audio Movers, and then essentially the second one that came out was Ginger Audio with the Ground Control Sphere, where they had the iRender plugin.
I did
a little video, and then people got confused, because Ginger Audio actually does not say that you need an Apple Silicon Mac. They just say Mac.
Right.
And it actually turns out that that is not. So if you're purchasing Ground Control Sphere, make sure that you try it first, because their marketing material is not complete. So kind of that's interesting, actually. No, I used Immerse, Embody is the company, Embody Immerse a little bit. It's actually a pretty good one. What I was missing so far was the head tracking. And this now with Apple Music is in there. So you can actually use a kind of head tracking that is nice. And with that cat, I think that was mentioned on our Discord server. I'm not quite sure. I can't remember exactly what the source was, but there is an update to the Apple Music payout. Apparently, if you are releasing your music with spatial audio, you are getting a higher payout now, Sam. Do you remember how that was?
Yeah, so it's all a bit complex how the payout works, but this is the percentage of the percentage that the artist would get, I think. That's how I understood it. So there's the artist, there's a label, and there's probably a rights owner to most music. Sometimes I guess it could all be the same.
Yeah, exactly. If you're releasing, you are the same.
But I think for the level of a musician that is going to see a change in that 10%, you're going to be the higher kind of streaming type artist going into the millions of streams, I'd have thought. But yeah, it's obviously an incentive to, I guess, for back catalog, because a lot of modern stuff seems to be mixed more in Dolby Atmos or Sony 360.
There's
a huge amount of back catalog. Well, yeah, the demixing is a big topic.
A lot of demixing will be necessary.
That's a big topic at the moment.
Vocal separation.
Because, yeah, I mean, we didn't really touch on this, Anthony, but a lot of the time the multi-track or the stems aren't available, especially in the analog days. They might have recorded over the analog tape in order to save money because they were a new band at the time. They didn't have the money to buy multiple tapes, mm-hmm. so they literally recorded one track and then recorded the next track over it and just bounced it to wherever it was going to be mastered or whatever. Sometimes there might be political reasons where the manager's got the rights but they can't get hold of the stems because he's not releasing them. All sorts of stuff like that goes on. So they call it, they lack the assets, that's what the engineers call it. So it's basically trying to do a spatial mix, but you've only got a stereo source that you can upmix to a certain extent, where you're just literally just spreading that stereo source out to the multiple speakers mm-hmm. around you. But you're limited by just frequency splitting or maybe loudness splitting and stuff like that. You can't really say, I want the guitar to go over here and I want the vocal over there, which is kind of what my Demix Me service comes in, is I try and give them the stems to separate it out more.
Yeah. Because with each stem you get, like if you use like Demix to get four stems, right? Like each stem has the two channels too that you can kind of rebalance to get a better spatial mix too, I would assume.
Yeah. Sometimes if it's more in the left channel, mm-hmm. Sometimes you might be able to separate the stereo left and right into two stems. So you might have a bass in the right channel and a vocal in the left, and that would allow mm-hmm. you to split it. But it's surprising how, even though it's not a perfect separation, because it's all played collectively back, and some models even null back to the stereo if you combine them all. Yeah. It's essentially it's a non-destructive separation. So in the Atmos space, you can get away, even though it's not perfect, you can pan stuff around mm-hmm. And separate it out of the stereo field because it's clean enough that the brain doesn't notice that it's not perfect, mm-hmm. not a perfect separation. So I think possibly with this Apple Music payout change, definitely back catalog is going to be
back catalog. I was
just going to say, if you're getting all the even if the audio was separated, if you're getting it from all spaces, you won't notice the subtle imperfections from the separation itself.
The process of encoding it to a mm-hmm. lossy format is artifacty. They'll rob it's almost like a spectral kind of separation where they'll borrow, they'll reduce the file size down of the stream by essentially taking the stuff that you're not really going to notice that they've taken out. But when you solo that speaker, it's artifacted. It sounds like old MP3 kind of playing, but collectively it all comes back together and sounds normal again. So
exactly. Yeah.
And you can get away with that in the demixing sort of style as well, because it's, it's all going to null back to the stereo essentially. So
exactly.
As long as you don't literally pan it out of place entirely, it spatializes quite well. Anyway. Yeah, so that's,
I'm kind of curious. I think we talked about that at the I think it was the very first episode a little bit. If there's sort of a market developing for studios or kind of institutions that have sort of these collections, and I'm thinking for our own university, kind of Philadelphia had a very active music scene in the second half of the 20th century, and when the studios went bust, our university got all the recordings, and we have huge collection of essentially four track recordings, some very famous ones, and I'm kind of curious if there's like a market developing for people that are kind of taking these, because four tracks obviously are not enough, right? So you want to actually kind of separate it out even further. Is there development in that area? Is this Apple movement to kind of push the idea that you need to provide spatial audio in order to get a higher payout, is that kind of fostering people to actually look into that, to go back into their catalog, into the original kind of master tapes and try to recreate something with higher track counts?
I think to a certain extent they have to, if they haven't got the assets, the stems, but they want to take advantage of a higher payout from Apple. So to a certain extent, they're gonna find ways. The problem is that just up mixing a stereo track is definitely frowned upon especially by the engineers. They don't want to be associated with music that is just an upmix. They wanna actually do the work and separate the objects in Atmos or Sony or whatever. To some extent, it can save. You can get the same kind of result, but a lot quicker, because you're already working with the stereo master, and they're always trying to match the stereo in terms of how it sounds and how it feels. They're not trying to change. Like the artist decided that is how they wanted the stereo track to sound.
So the original master tapes might not even be an advantage then, right? Do I understand that right?
Possibly, yeah. Possibly, you might find that. Because everyone's familiar, especially with older songs, they're so familiar with that stereo track that you, even in a spatial sense, you can't change it too much, because it will lose the intent of the artist originally said and signed off that piece of music. So engineers have, Amos engineers have told me they like the fact that they're starting with the actual stereo sound, but they've got the freedom to move it because I've demixed so there's definitely, I mean, obviously the artifacting can become an issue if they do want to stray far from the stereo field, because if something is separated and it's not really, really clean, you cannot move it to extremes. You will know your brain will just say, oh, this sounds like there's a bit of a hole there in the audio, which is coming back to the demudding and all sorts of stuff. It's all related to that. So I've spoken to a couple of engineers that are in NAMM at the moment, and I know it's quite a topic, the demixing side of it, for Atmos, because of this layout and
I imagine that 10% is kind of, it can be a lot.
For some artists, well, the top some, that top yeah. sort of 1%, yeah. it can be a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. Not for me. I earned like 5 cents or something. Oh Jesus. Okay, so next thing, and that's actually something that got me excited, but that's something that essentially is a little bit away from you guys. SSA Plugins, which is a developer of Ambisonics plugins, came out with an update to their plugin suite, and their plugins are now 10th order Ambisonics. That is possible because Reaper can now do 128 channel tracks, and 10th Order Ambisomics needs 121 channels. So you have 121 channel audio. That is the nerdiest thing ever. It's and you can do that. And I actually tried it out, and it's surprising. It is actually quite efficient. I was thinking that I probably need a supercomputer to run it, like something that Anthony had, like with an A6000, which is like a super GPU. But no, actually, it actually runs fine. It was most surprising. But Reaper looks totally weird with kind of this 121 kind of channel kind of meters.
So, you get about three meters on a whole screen.
it's like absurd. But I talked to Peter from SSA plugins. Actually, I had the beta versions before it was released, and he said he knows that is complete overkill. But it does. He did it anyway because, I mean, first of all, it's possible, and then there is a market for those things. You know, kind of 121 channels, and I'm not really that much of an expert in that. But people tell me that once you get beyond 100 speaker setups, and there are these speaker setups, especially if you are in an environment where you have multiple listeners, so for example in a stadium or something, then these high channel counts actually make sense. Obviously for you and me it doesn't. So if you have an Atmos setup, third order is fine.
I was just thinking within 10 tracks you could, well, in 10 tracks of 10th order you would be in like thousands of channels. which is kind of more than even the largest orchestra, probably. So.
No, it's sort of, you know, one thing about ambisonics is that there are certain computations in ambisonics that are much more efficient than in channel-based audio, and there are other that are less efficient. So, for example, head tracking is extremely efficient in ambisonics because a rotation is a linear transformation in ambisonics. So there are certain things that are much, much faster in ambisonics. So 121 channels is nothing, but there are other things where things get a little icky.
And then we had
two announcements, and one, and that's something I think Sam, you have been always excited about, and that is sort of GPU audio. They announced, I think it's a collaboration with they are about to release a spatial audio reverb.
It's with Mantra.
I wasn't quite sure. Without the A. I wasn't quite sure if it's Mantra, Montra, Muntra.
This follows on from the kind of their first GPU audio's first partnership was with Vienna, with the MIR.
That was also
reverb.
GPU audio?
Yeah, that was also GPU audio. Yeah, this is kind of using CUDA cores to process audio instead of the CPU. You could say it's related to the demixing side of stuff a little bit. They're using the huge number of cores that are available in CUDA to process lots of streams of audio in parallel, basically. I think that's the idea. So for things like a reverb, and I think this one is more down what I was getting excited about, with kind of trying to physically model how the sound is working in a room. Like a basic reverb is just kind of a reflection and kind of a delay, delay or whatever. It's an emulation of what is actually happening. Whereas with a GPU, because you've got so many parallel processes possible, all at very low latency, you can almost model each individual, kind of like, it's not a particle, but you could imagine it like a sound particle bouncing off a wall, and you can, I think that's that, build up very realistic, very dense reverbs, or very realistic reverbs. I think that's the idea. But this is quite new, so I've not had a chance to look at it. I don't know if there's a demo
It isn't out yet. It just announced it, if I'm completely mistaken. Yeah. But that's going to be an interesting one. There was a comment on one of my videos which was interesting, and I have not yet found, because quite frankly I don't have Mir, so I don't have the Vienna kind of version of GPU audio, but there was somebody who commented that when he was running the GPU audio version of the Vienna reverb, then certain other plugins would crash. So it's opening a completely new field that I think is interesting. And making access of the GPU.
GPU audio is the kind of like the SDK to create the VST plugin.
Yeah.
Kind of with. So it's giving the developers a way to access the GPU, but through the familiarity of a VST development, which is what they're going to be used to. So yeah, no doubt there's glitches.
I think it was with the Immerse system, and I was thinking, and I honestly haven't looked into it yet, but it could very well be that certain developers already took advantage of GPUs without essentially making that much public, and then now these things are clashing, right? So there's always the possibility. Anyway, that was something that I found was interesting. So
yeah.
So if you are kind of going into that realm, be aware that these are the new things and unexpected things can happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I have one more thing, which was an announcement. That's actually a minor announcement. Eventide kind of updated their Black Hole and MicroPitch immersive plugins to be now 9.1.6. They used to be, I think, only up to 7.1.4. But now everybody seems to be going 9.1.6. So this seems to become the new standard in Dolby Atmos, right?
I think people have, similar to Ambisonics, the higher the speaker count, the higher the resolution, I guess. I think maybe a lot of it's driven that Pro Tools is now able to host kind of more than 7.1.2 on a track or a bus. So I think that's partly why even though it's not overall, Pro Tools is not probably the most dominant DAW, it's the most dominant in Atmos. So I think the development of Atmos related or spatial related plugins generally follows Pro Tools in some way.
It's sort of that is true. And you know, kind of Pro Tools, and we talked earlier that Macs are still dominant in the music space, and quite frankly, partly also because of Pro Tools, because Pro Tools on Windows is just a nightmare. So if you want to use Pro Tools, you almost have to use a Mac. And Pro Tools certainly still leads the way, at least in the industry, and which is a good thing. You know, kind of 9.1.6 wasn't particularly well defined how the speaker layout is actually done. So kind of having at least now the Pro Tools standard, I think, helps to standardize everything. I think that's going to be important.
Yeah.
And I think that was pretty much everything that we had so far. Once again, you know, kind of as we are recording this, there are probably new things coming out because NAMM is happening at this point. All the things that are going to happen after we record that, we're going to cover in the next month, next month episode, which will be in March. And I think that was everything. Sam, do you have anything else?
No, just to say many thanks to Anthony, to Andrzej. We'll give all the links out to what we covered, where to download the Ultimate Vocal Remover. Have you got anything else you'd like to say, Anthony?
No, just thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Kind of explain everything.
Hopefully a lot, because I think a lot of it is kind of like not a black art, but it's just not a familiar kind of thing, even in audio. Like, you speak to engineers and they don't really got a clue what you're talking about when you're saying, oh, we can demix the vocal, or there's these models that we can use, and I use Isotope RX, it doesn't do a very good job.
But I would assume it was unheard of even just 10 years ago.
Every new engineer that approaches me and says, I've got this stereo track, can you demix it, every single one will say, wow, I've never heard anything separate that good before. And they're in the industry full-time professionally, so I think that a lot of it is this disconnect where the commercial side is almost not quite as good as
Because it's so well established.
Yeah.
I think one of the and I see this in our college, right? So one of the things is that this is just a such a massive paradigm shift in terms of programming and how you develop software. These networks function completely differently, and the vast majority of people have not yet made that switch. So they think in terms of algorithms and sort of ifs and whens and theirs and kind of all these traditional kind of flowcharts, and don't really understand that these programs work completely differently and therefore have a completely different realm of possibilities, and are also kind of advancing much, much faster than anything else, because essentially they have to be trained. They're not really programmed, they're trained, really, right? Yeah. So I think a lot of people will be surprised what's going to happen over the next couple of years. These things are going to develop so fast. It's going to be fun. Yeah, I would be if I would be you. It's sort of you have something really special and thank you for that.
Thanks again for having me.
Okay, cool.
Pleasure.
Thanks everybody. It was my pleasure to be the host here, even though I kind of was mainly listening today, but that was a lot of fun. And once again, if you have not subscribed to this channel yet, please do so immediately, because we are going to come out with the next episode in a month or so, and it's going to be equally exciting. And if you have any questions or comments, you can always use the comment section, or you can also reach us directly. We have some links in the description below. And with that being said, see you at the next podcast.
Cheers out.
Bye, guys.